Speaking today with Michael Belfiore. He is a journalist who's written about space flight and advanced technology for Popular Scientist, New Scientist, Wired.com, Air and Space, and the Financial Times. His first book was Rocketeers, How a Visionary Band of Business Leaders, Engineers, and Pilots is Boldly Privatizing Space. But today we're talking about his new book, The Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World from the Internet to Artificial Limbs. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thanks. Well, and I'm holding up the book right now, so
okay, you
people can see what it looks like.
I'll hold up my copy, too. Here's the book. I have to hold it very slowly so it doesn't blur. So, yeah, there's the book. So this is great history. You've written it in a very accessible style, talking about your relationships and your discussions with these folks. You spent, the last 3 or 4 years getting deep into the bowels of DARPA? Is that about the time?
Well, significantly less than that, which was which made things difficult. The last book, the Rocket book, actually that was my third book. I had two unpublished science fiction novels in a trunk over here.
Oh, well, hopefully those will see the light of day.
And then another, I wrote a book for young adults about life aboard space stations.
Oh.
Just before the Rocket book. That was published by Lucent Books.
Excellent.
And so I had about 3 years on the Rocket book, but only about half that time on the DARPA book.
Ah.
Which caused some difficulty for me because it took me about 6 months of that time just to get in the door at DARPA.
Yeah.
And so
You chronicled how you kind of finagled your way in. So you promised to do a film, work with film crew to help make a film about them and all that.
That's right. I had a contract in hand to do this book based on some preliminary discussion with the public affairs office at DARPA that I would be allowed to get interviews and have access to the agency. Little did I know it was going to be a much more involved process than that to get the access. I mean, it's about 6 months of hammering at the door pretty persistently, and then with the help of a National Geographic film crew who also wanted to do a special based around my book, all of us hammering away, I finally got an interview with Tony Tether, who was then the director of DARPA, and then sat down with him in a meeting. It was supposed to be a phone interview, and I showed up in person to make my case and brought my Rocket book and a cover of Popular Science that had one of his projects on the cover that I had written about, and just basically pleaded my case, say, hey, you know, this would be a good thing, because they're really short of people to work there. The turnover rate is about 25% a year for program managers, people who are cooking up the projects that get farmed out.
And why is that?
Well, it's by design, and that's partly what makes DARPA so effective. That was true from day one when it was founded. In 1958, the idea was it would be a sort of quick strike organization. You'd have some people very focused on specific problems. They'd get in there, get the job done, and then get out. So there's no entrenchment. There's nobody there who's a career bureaucrat. These are all academics and people from industry who have got a passion to do a particular type of work. And then when it's done, they all have their expiration date printed on their badges. So everyone knows who they talk to in meetings or wherever they go. Everyone knows when they're expected to leave. So that's both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength because people are there to do their work, not be bureaucrats. But it's a weakness in that there's constant need for recruiting over there.
Hmm.
So Taylor thought that the book would help.
Let's rewind to the origins. We're talking about the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration. When was it founded?
It's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Agency, okay.
And it was founded for the same reason NASA was, and almost at the same time, a little bit before NASA. In 1957, Sputnik was launched by the Russians, and the Eisenhower administration was very concerned that we had lost the technological edge in this country. So what to do? A panel of scientists decided that we had to do some kind of response, and ultimately that response was NASA. And the idea was, well, they got the high ground in space, the Russians, so let's try to get higher. And ultimately, we ended up going all the way to the moon and got the ultimate high ground. But before that, so NASA was founded late 58. ARPA, as it was called then, without the D for defense, was founded early 1958 for the same reason. So we were going to use this real, you know, quick, you know, into the breach kind of technique with ARPA, get something going really fast. So they started a lot of the projects that NASA then took over later in the year, including the moon rocket. Wasn't known that it would go to the moon at that time, but that was that project, the Saturn V and the F1 engines that went with it, that started out as an ARPA project before NASA took it over.
So you also talk about the role that DARPA has had in innovating in scramjets. Can you describe what a scramjet is?
Yeah, scramjets is an aircraft, an air-breathing aircraft, so like a jet engine on a jet airliner of different design. Same idea, though, breathing air rather than some kind of oxidizer in the manner of a rocket that can go hypersonic speed. So that's five times the speed of sound or faster. This could be, if the work in progress succeeds, could be a revolutionary form of transportation. You could fly halfway around the world, basically from one point to any other point on the planet within about 4 hours.
And that is a kind of an intermediary step between airplanes and spaceflight, as I understand it, because it reaches suborbital heights or something like that?
Yeah, back in 86, President Reagan used his State of the Union address to announce the new Orient Express, he called it. This was going to be a hypersonic, the National Aerospace Plane Project. And the idea was, at the time, it was thought that hypersonic air-breathing airplanes could actually reach Mach 25, which is what you need to do to get to orbit. Since then, it's been, you know, further work has been done to show that probably Mach 15 is probably the outer envelope. So that project failed pretty spectacularly. Lots of money into it. President Clinton canceled it, the National Aerospace Plane. But the interesting thing is that all the different pieces of the problem went underground and went to various smaller research groups just focused on that problem. So materials that can survive sustained speed in the atmosphere, hypersonic speed without melting, and the engines themselves. How do you get an air-breathing engine to go that fast? Because turbines and jet engines will break down at about Mach 3. So that's about the limit of the materials that we have that can do high-speed flight. But a scramjet operates without those turbines. So it's kind of a stovepipe. The air gets compressed just by the speed at which it's entering the system.
It sounds like a Rube Goldberg kind of contraption, because you have to get going at that speed to get the air into it at that speed, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. There's most of the projects so far that have been done, this has been done experimentally, but for a few seconds at a time. So NASA did the X-43 in 2004 at about Mach 6, I think it was, for about 10 seconds. And that was a world record at the time. So DARPA is trying to do this, and they're funding some folks at Pratt & Whitney Rocketdyne and through the Air Force Research Laboratory. They're working on an engine now that can run continuously as long as its fuel holds out. So that's the next step that's needed to build these systems. So I went and saw one of these being tested.
Cool.
At a wind tunnel at NASA Langley. And these guys were pretty excited about the work they were doing. A lot of them were survivors from the original NASP project that Reagan had started, and they were suffering from what they call a NASP hangover. And they were a little concerned about whether they would continue their funding under the new presidential administration was about to come in. And I asked one guy there, well, how do you deal with that uncertainty? And he just said, well, keep your head down and color.
So the real heroes of your book are the program managers. So you, as you described, they come in with this expiration date stamped on them, and they know that they're in a special environment with special kinds of funding, and they really set ambitious goals for themselves. So I was very impressed with your solar cell example, that the guys who started that solar cell project in a couple years ago, they wanted to increase the efficiency of solar cells by 10 times, and everybody in the solar cell field thought that was a crazy goal.
Yeah. That's typical of a DARPA project. They want to do things that they call DARPA hard. So if there isn't a big risk of failure, it's probably not worth doing. It's sort of the feeling over there. And that was the case here. Douglas Kirkpatrick started this program with very efficient solar cells, very high efficiency solar cells project. A lot of these projects have rather prosaic names. And he took this idea to a conference of electrical engineers working in solar power and said, we're going to make solar cells that are 50% efficient. So in other words, 50% of the sunlight striking them turns to electricity. And this caused an uproar. These people thought, well, first of all, it was crazy. Second of all, this guy was being irresponsible because he was setting them all up for failure. And his project, as far as they were concerned, was going to prove that the solar industry had no potential. But as sometimes happens with these projects, they actually have succeeded, or very close. The last I heard, they were about 42% at the University of Delaware, where this project is based with DARPA money. They've come up with a way to split the sunlight into its constituent wavelengths and then guide these wavelengths to specific types of material designed just to absorb those wavelengths so they can capture as much of the sun as possible coming into the system.
So all of these projects ultimately do have defense purposes. So the solar cell project was designed to provide portable power for soldiers' computing equipment in the field and communications equipment. The biofuels project that they were working on was to try to fuel our air fleet with biofuels, the prosthetics for our soldiers who are coming back without limbs. So one of the questions about DARPA is, how much trickle down do you think there are from these various kinds of projects to the corporate world? How quickly do we benefit from what DARPA is innovating?
It's hard to quantify, and I don't know that DARPA itself is very interested in quantifying that. By their very nature, they're forward-looking, and with this high turnover in personnel, there's not much institutional memory there, and there isn't a lot of good record-keeping. So it's hard to quantify that, but we can look at past examples. DARPA founded the Internet. The project that became the Internet was called ARPANET, and it started as a at the time, it was called ARPA, and it started as an ARPA program just to link different types of computers together so that research scientists could share their data and thus help work that was being done at universities for the Department of Defense, but as well as their other projects that was going on. And that's a case in which the military benefit was, well, it was certainly the reason for the funding. It wasn't so specific, you see what I'm saying? And that's a lot of the work that comes out of DARPA is that way. So the Internet's one example. GPS is another one that started as a program for the Navy. It was called Transit, and the idea was to let Navy ships and subs keep track of each other and themselves with a satellite-based system. It's the first time that had ever been done, and it was the first time the principles behind modern GPS were demonstrated. And that's still really typical of the work that DARPA does. Another example today is their autonomous vehicles programs, these Urban Challenge Race, Grand Challenge Race, a series of three races for autonomous vehicles.
For DARPA, that's a pretty public challenge. Have they been trying to promote their benefit to society with more of these kind of public events like the Urban Challenge? And describe what the Urban Challenge is.
Yeah, Urban Challenge was a robot car race that had back in late 2007 several teams. Forget what they started with. I think it was around 26 teams to begin with, who were all went through qualifying runs, and then it came down to just 11 for the final race. And the idea was you'd have these robot cars racing each other in city streets. Now, these were empty city streets to avoid any collateral damage. But the idea is they did follow traffic laws, stop at stop signs, stay within speed limits, signal their turns, all these things. It's a very strange race because not only no one behind the wheel, but also the cars were moving at pretty safe speeds. So that was the Urban Challenge, the last in the series of three races. I forget what the first part of your question was. You asked me something.
Well, it's about the trickle-down benefits to society. Oh, no, that was an earlier question. The question I was just asking was whether these public challenges are a part of a more conscious public strategy on the part of DARPA, because they had some negative press in the early part of this decade, and it seems like there's been more openness at DARPA, and this urban challenge has certainly been far more open than many other projects.
That's true. Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because there's a constant tension at DARPA between having to, like any government agency or any organization in general, to justify their existence and what they do and their budgets by demonstrating results, and that involves a certain amount of publicity. And also, as I mentioned, there's this need to recruit not only people who work at DARPA, but also researchers who might want to do work as contractors. The only way those folks are going to get interested in DARPA is if they hear about it. So there is that continual need. But at the same time, DARPA seems to operate, in a sense, best when it flies under the radar. They don't want too much publicity. And as you mentioned earlier on, right after 2001 and 9/11, they had a controversial program that not only shut down an entire program and office at DARPA, but also threatened to really change the way they did business, which is to sort of operate semi-autonomously.
Well, let's talk about that. Poindexter came in and the project Total Information Awareness, and between the two of them, they had a real low point. So what was that all about?
Total Information Awareness was this program that Tony Tether, this guy I was talking about who directed DARPA until very recently. He was the longest serving director and who allowed me to get access to write my book. But he came into DARPA just before 9/11, and he described to me watching smoke coming up out of the Pentagon in the distance. By this time, DARPA had moved out of the Pentagon into its own office building in Arlington. And he had this feeling that all the pieces of the puzzle existed in some database. In other words, some computer system, some analyst somewhere had all the information needed to stop those terrorists before they attacked. And the idea of total information awareness was to create a system that would gather all this data that was flowing through different federal agencies, law enforcement, so on, gather it in one place so that it would be easy for human analysts to interpret. So that was the intention. But then they brought in John Poindexter, who had gained notoriety in the 80s as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. And he had been implicated in lying to Congress and things like this. And Tether insisted to me that he was the right choice for this program, but he brought with him a lot of publicity, negative publicity to begin with, that didn't help DARPA. And then William Safire at the New York Times got wind of this program and just laid into it, saying that this is going to just be terrible for privacy, all of our financial transactions, everything we do online, our phone calls, every kind of data trail we leave is going to be accessible to the government and quantified and analyzed. And it would since end up as a dossier on everybody who has any kind of imprint, leaves any kind of imprint in the digital world. And lots of other journalists got into this, started questioning this, and Congress got involved. There were hearings. DARPA changed the name of the program to Terror Information Awareness, to just try to emphasize that, no, we're not going to just track every citizen. We're only going to look at people who are already suspect, people who are already sort of being kept tabs on, but it was just too great a push against this program for it to survive. So Poindexter had to be let go, the program was canceled, and Tether almost lost his job, which he tells me is a mark of a good DARPA director, that he's always on the verge of getting fired. He felt that was the mark of a good director. Rumsfeld sent over a messenger to tell him this: you're getting close, Tether.
Getting close to getting fired.
Yeah. Which Tether took as a compliment.
I have to tell you, I never missed an opportunity to excoriate the Bush administration, but the Total Information Awareness Project for me was kind of like a fantasy of what a sociologist in charge of military secrets would do. I mean, I'm a quantitative sociologist, and to be able to put together every single piece of information about Americans and start mining that data is really sounds wonderful to me. So I was never that down on total information awareness as others. I'm more concerned about the kind of aggregation of private sector data about us, which seems to have more nefarious purpose behind it. But at any rate, DARPA, this has been one of the concerns about DARPA, and that the secrecy of DARPA, there might be things going on there. Now, you've been able to talk about some of these projects with DARPA's cooperation, but obviously there are many projects that they must be engaged in, which you're not able to, you didn't have access to, or you're not able to talk about. And I think there's, you know, there's a kind of conspiratorial frame of mind on both the left and the right in the United States worrying about what kind of super soldiers might be being built there, what kinds of, you know, nefarious information scavenging schemes might be going on. Your exposure seemed to be, you know, the book is almost a hagiography. I mean, you really liked these guys. You seem to really enjoy the go-get-em kind of attitude of the folks that you met. But do you think that there was a floor in that building, that there was something going on that you should have known about that you didn't find, weren't able to find out about?
Well, it's impossible for me to say. And you're right. I did write a positive treatment of the agency, something that I'm interested in as a journalist to cover things that I'm excited about. And I try to make that bias clear, too, that I'm not trying to write, for lack of a better word,
an expose.
Really well-balanced account. I try to go after the information, try to find negative things to highlight if necessary. But I was only given access, I'm told, to about half of what they do, or had even the potential to even know about half of what they do. So the other half is secret. And, of course, I have no idea.
Could be.
What it could be. I do know that from talking to the people there, meeting them, meeting Tether, just my gut was that their hearts were in the right place, that they really were trying to do good, you know, trying to help the good guys and working on a lot of things that they felt had benefit beyond the military, even though that wasn't their mission. DARPA's clearly stated mission is to work just for the military. They're not trying to deliberately foster dual purpose. They did that in the 90s, actually. There was an explicit mission for DARPA in the 90s to develop dual-use technology, which Tether felt was a failure. And of course, a lot of people felt Tether was a failure. I'm going to that a little bit in the book. That he was so focused on that one mission, pure military, get it done fast, specific application. A lot of researchers I talked to felt that that's just so short-sighted that the ARPANET would never have happened if under Tether, because it was too ill-defined. It didn't have that quick payoff behind it. It wasn't really that focused on military. Tether argues differently. He says, no, we do still fund the equivalent of ARPANET. So that one time in the 90s, they did try a dual-use kind of approach.
Well, as you say, because they have these short terms at DARPA, the program managers and scientists there must be a circulation of the skills and ideas that they have, even if they're under some kind of, you know, classification for some period of time. They still go back into industry and corporate world and government and take those ideas and skills with them. So there must be some kind of circulation. But on the basis of your exposure to DARPA, what lessons do you think that academia and the corporate world can learn from DARPA's relative success on these projects?
Well, I think for any organization engaged in technology development, that DARPA has a lot of lessons to offer, and there's a kind of a specific formula that DARPA started under that continues 50 years later, that you have, as a counterexample, in NASA forming at the same time under quite different conditions. So I think it's instructive to look at the two extremes and see that one really works really well, and the other one, NASA, has a lot of problems. This is my opinion. But so, for instance, DARPA farms out all of its lab work, all of its development. So this gives it the ability to come up with an idea quickly, get some work behind it, and then if it's not working, to quickly drop it, move something to something else. That, I think, is very interesting to as a lesson, because if you've got big laboratories like NASA does, I mentioned the Moon Project, well, they took over the whole operation that was building the moon rockets instead of just farming out contracts to them. Now, Huntsville, the rocket center there, the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, is an integral part of the agency and not easily dismissed. I mean, there's thousands of workers there. There's lots of infrastructure standing out there. This has to be a consideration in anything that NASA does. They've got all of these centers all over the country with political force behind it and money, and this is a problem for them. DARPA, on the other hand, they've worked with certain groups throughout its history, but they're able to easily drop a group for a short time or pick it up later or fund another aspect of what they're doing. One of these groups, Stanford Research Institute, now just SRI, is a good example of that. They have to go after their own funding and work with other agencies and other companies to keep going. They're not just dependent on DARPA. And DARPA, it doesn't have to continue to support those researchers even when they're not at work on programs that they're interested in funding. So that's one example. And the other one is the quick turnaround. The term limits. So the longest serving director before Tether was there for 3-4 years. Tether was there for, 8 years or something, 9 years. About 8 years, I think. Mm. That was very unusual. And the program manager still had this turnover rate, 25% a year. So that ensures that they don't have career bureaucrats there. And this is true of NASA. There are a lot of people there just very interested in hanging on to their nice office and their position, and they'll protect that position.
I don't see term limits being a quick sell for academia or the corporate world or government for that matter.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I'm saying this is a special circumstance, DARPA. There's some lessons there. Now, if you ask me how to apply that in certain places like academia, well, and that's another story. But I think it's instructive just to look at mm-hmm. what's working over there, and to maybe it's possible to create smaller groups within a larger organization that retain some of these principles. That might be one way to go.
Cool. Well, I've been speaking with Michael Belfiore. He's at michaelbelfiore.com, and we've been talking about his book, which I'm showing again. You can hold yours up too, Michael. Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World from the Internet to Artificial Limbs. And it's a great introduction to this agency, which is doing a lot of important work, which he documents in the book.
I'm hoping, that people will read this and be inspired and realize that there are people out there working on some of the most important problems that we're facing. Energy use, climate change, all kinds of things, and hopefully they'll be inspired to contribute to some of these efforts as well.
Well, I think if we can inspire more people to get interested in applied engineering and trying to figure out problems like how to make arms that work for people without arms, that's precisely the kind of inspiration we need from science and technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, thanks very much.